WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Dexter Filkins has spent a lot of time in conflict zones, whether it's the war in Afghanistan, the American occupation of Iraq, and the uprisings in Syria and Yemen. But one conflict older still than all of those wars is the trouble in Kashmir, the only Muslim-majority state in India. Dexter traveled to Kashmir earlier this year to report on a violent crackdown instigated by the Indian government and its Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Modi rose to power on a platform of Hindu nationalism and hostility to India's Muslim population. Here's Dexter Filkins.
Like so many things in the modern world, the current conflict between India and Pakistan over Kashmir dates to the dissolution of the British Empire in 1947. And what happened was the Muslim-majority states became Pakistan. The Hindu-majority states became India. Kashmir, nestled high up in the Himalayas, is split in half, basically two-thirds to India, one-third to Pakistan, and it's been that way ever since. And in the beginning, when the Indians wrote the Constitution, they gave Kashmir a special status. And basically what they did was grant really broad powers of autonomy and self-rule. But since the very beginning, there was always a strain, a very powerful strain in Indian politics, and there was always a strain of Indian political leaders who resented the fact that what they regarded as special treatment, favorable treatment for Muslims. And they always vowed that they would change it. Narendra Modi became Prime Minister of India in 2014, was just re-elected in 2019. He's now the most powerful Prime Minister that India has had in decades. And when upon his re-election earlier this year, one of the first things he did was to essentially suspend the special status of Kashmir. He just did it in a stroke. Modi flooded Kashmir with Indian troops. They've cut off internet, they've cut off television, they've cut off telephone service, everything. So basically, Kashmiris are cut off from the rest of the country, and they're also cut off from each other. The vision of Modi is to impose on Kashmir essentially his vision for the rest of India, which is, first and foremost, India is for the Hindus and the minorities, including the Muslims, are second class. I was trying to figure out a way to write this India story and to write the Kashmir story, and more important, to get into Kashmir, from which foreign reporters have been banned. So I decided to call this very interesting woman, very compelling woman, and really one of the most prominent investigative reporters in India. Her name is Rana Ayub. She's 35 years old and a Muslim, and utterly fearless and completely bold. And so I called her up out of the blue. I said, "Rana, my name's Dexter. Can I come out and can we go to Kashmir together?" Long pause in the phone. Sure. So I flew to Mumbai. We got on an airplane together. And we flew to Srinagar, the capital of Kashmir. We landed in the airport. There were soldiers and police everywhere. There's a big sign when you walk in saying "Foreigners register here." I had put on local dress, and I just kind of stared very intently at the ground. And we walked out together. Rana, how are you?
I'm good, Dexter. Good to hear from you.
So we went up to Kashmir together, and I did my best to look Kashmiri and put on a kurta, the local outfit. It wasn't very convincing. You were kind of laughing at me, I think, at one point, and said, you know, I'm about 99% sure that you're going to get arrested. But we made it through. Like, we got, you know, we got on the plane. We flew to Srinagar, and I thought we did pretty well.
Yeah. You know, from the time that you wore the kurta to the time that we boarded the flight, till the time we landed in Srinagar, I was convinced that this is not going to happen. And then when it did happen, it was quite a journey. It was remarkable. The scale of the violence and the scale of detention and how a story as big as that, of that intensity, was actually being hidden from the world media.
Explain to people, you know, people in the United States, they kind of hear about Kashmir and they go, God, it's really bad over there. What's Modi trying to do? And why are the Kashmiri people so angry? Because I think we found a lot of anger there.
Right. Oh, yes, we did. So Kashmiris have a special status in the sense that non-Kashmiris cannot buy land in the valley, cannot invest in the valley. And it is a sensitive place. It's on the border of India and Pakistan. There has been a struggle which has been going on for its own statehood, for its independent statehood, for decades now. And there has been insurgency in the valley.
Yes.
The special status that has been granted to Kashmir was revoked by the Indian government without consulting the stakeholders in Kashmir, without consulting the democratic leaders who were put behind bars, who are still behind bars. The human rights activist, every single human rights activist is behind bars in Kashmir.
So you and I think we had that one really remarkable day when we got in a car and we snuck out of Srinagar, out into the villages, where I think it's fair to say the insurgency has a lot of support. And we interviewed those two young guys had been arrested or just grabbed by the Indian Army a couple weeks before. And remember, they walked us through that kind of what they had been through. You know, they said, well, we were beaten, we were tortured, we were interrogated. They beat us with bamboo rods, and they even used electricity on us. And I remember, I think his name was Musafar, he rolled up his leg, and he showed us those burn marks on his legs. And that, you know, that was the moment I knew, okay, this is real. Then, of course, the further he went talking about it, he started crying.
I mean, these teenagers that we met, Central Paramilitary Forces and the Rashtriya Rifles took the brothers away, threatened the woman and the family that now that Kashmir, the special status in Kashmir has been revoked, they can marry their woman. One of the women said that she had to hide her daughter-in-law because the Central Paramilitary Forces threatened them with rape. So that's the kind of story. I mean, not just that. Look at the story of the 13-year-old boy, Ashik. You know, when we went there, he was playing cricket. And I almost thought for a second, I said, hang on, this boy was behind bars for 30 days. And why is it so normal? Why is he playing cricket? And his father said, this is the way of life in Kashmir. He was also detained 30 years ago. It's like a cycle of injustice. And this boy comes to us and, you know, when we were recording his interview, he showed the marks on his back and the wounds. And it was inhuman. It was inhuman, to say the least, that they could inflict this on a 13-year-old.
So let's talk about you for a second. You know, I think what we saw in Kashmir and what we, I think it's fair to say, what we've been seeing in India since Prime Minister Modi was first elected in 2014, it's become a tough place to be a Muslim in India, I think it's fair to say. And the sort of Hindu-Muslim divide has been in India for, you know, forever. But you've lived your whole life on that divide. When you were just the girl in 1992, there were really horrendous, bloody riots that kind of swept Mumbai. And yet your family was caught right in the middle of that, and you had to flee. Tell us about that moment.
So we lived in a pretty cosmopolitan society near the Sahar International Airport, where we were the only Muslim in a predominantly Hindu society. And we never really felt threatened. I mean, we never really had a religious identity to ourselves because My father was a part of the progressive writers movement. He was also a government school teacher. So we were never really seen with a religious identity. So I did not know what it was to be like a Muslim in India till 6 December 1992, when suddenly that evening, all hell broke loose in the country. Our neighbor, who was a Sikh guy, Mr. Bagga, he was sweating when he knocked at our door, and my father opened the door and he said, your daughters need to be taken somewhere because the mob is, rushing towards your house. They have swords in their hand. And my father said, what happened? He said, you're the only Muslim family here. We have to save you. You will not be spared because they're all coming for you. So we were whisked off, and we lived in a Sikh household for 3 months, and everybody used to come in the house and ask, okay, who are these people? And the hosts would say, oh, they're refugees. They're in a house for a couple of months. They're Muslims. And that's the first time the word, oh, they are Muslims, really stuck to me, because till then I did not see myself as a Muslim. The entire episode that gave me a religious identity, perhaps, was the most traumatic episode of my life.
So you, when those riots happened in Mumbai in 1992, I think you were 9 years old. 10 years later, there was another really horrific series of riots in the state of Gujarat. And riots is, in the case of Gujarat, it's not a very good descriptive word, because really most of that violence, after a kind of an initial attack, most of that violence was one way. It was Hindu on Muslim. So it's better really to describe what happened in Gujarat as a pogrom. I think probably 1,500 dead, maybe 150,000 people homeless. But you were 18, 19 years old, you were living in Mumbai, and then you told your mom you were going trekking in the Himalayas, but you didn't do that. Tell us what you did instead.
So I told her that I was going on a trek, but a night before, I had seen on television the first time visuals from the Gujarat riots, and I saw that, and it felt like I was reliving my childhood. What I saw at 9, it was repeating itself when I was 19, and it was traumatic again, and I didn't want to be helpless. So there was a friend whose sister was with the International Red Cross, and she was traveling. So I tagged along with her. We took a train from Mumbai Central Station. We landed in Ahmedabad, and then we went to Baroda. And my name is Rana, so there is a lot of ambiguity around my name because it can pass off as a Hindu name. So I went around as Rana with a bindi on my forehead. And so you would go around relief camps wherein we witnessed women who were raped and who were left there to just die. They were children with trauma written all over them. I mean, just traumatized eyes, their wounds bleeding. There were flies all over their bodies. And it was the worst thing any human being could actually witness.
Well, yeah, I think the Gujarat riots were a real turning point in modern Indian history. And I want to pause on those for a second. The remarkable thing, of course, looking back, is that the chief minister of the state of Gujarat at the time was none other than Narendra Modi, who later became the prime minister. And I think it's fair to say at the time and for years after, there were great suspicions that his government and even Modi himself had aided and abetted the riots and allowed them to happen and allowed them to kind of proceed. And in the aftermath of the riots, instead of recognizing and publicly declaring what a catastrophe this had been for the country, Modi really capitalized on those riots and on the kind of this upsurge in Hindu feeling and Hindu identity that came out of them. And he rode that. Really, I think it's fair to say he rode that all the way to the prime minister's office 12 years later. Explain that paradox, because it's still just incredibly puzzling to me.
So yes, I mean, Modi was not elected nationwide in 2014 despite what he did, but because of what he did in 2002. Because he endeared himself to the country as somebody who could take revenge on behalf of the Hindu nationalists. And revenge would mean the killing of Muslims during the Gujarat riots and looking the other way. The extrajudicial murder of Muslims who were labeled as terrorists. So he built this entire image of a Hindu nationalist under attack from Islamists. and the nation was singing his praise. You see what's happening right now in the country? It's just the Gujarat model being repeated on a national level.
So let's talk for a second about the book that made you famous.
Infamous.
It's about the riots in 2002. You basically decided that the only way you're going to find the truth is to wear a disguise, to pretend to be a filmmaker, and then just insinuated yourself into Gujarati society, and you insinuated yourselves into the whole world of the Hindu nationalists there so convincingly that they all ended up telling you their own roles and what happened and what they believe happened in 2002 and what really happened in 2002. Your book gets published. It becomes a bestseller. It makes you famous. It's kind of amazing. And on the other hand, you become the target of a really vicious social media campaign, which if you kind of look at closely, you see that the people who are orchestrating this campaign, or many of the people who are orchestrating the campaign and supporting it, they're Hindu nationalists and specifically BJP supporters, and even people who are, if not sitting next to the prime minister, people who would certainly like to be. Tell us about that social media campaign that really blasted you.
So there were these social media campaigns against me. And each time in the past, also every time I've done a big story or a big investigation, there has been a social media trend from Rana Ayoob sex CD to Rana Ayoob sleeping, etc. These hashtags have run. It took a more menacing toll in 2017 when I published the Hindi edition of the book and around the same time. And I was also given the Youth Icon of the Year Award by a magazine. And I spoke about my book being converted into a film. And the next day, there are these fake tweets generated and photoshopped and generated in my name. The one tweet says, I support child rapists in the name of Islam. And that tweet spreads like wildfire. In a couple of hours, another tweet is generated that says, I hate India and I hate all Indians. And that also creates an outrage. And then a source of mine from the ruling party, the BJP, sends me a message saying, I'm going to send you something, but please don't be upset. And I ask him to send it to me. It's a pornographic video, a porn video, like 2 minute 30 seconds with my image morphed in it. And I couldn't watch it beyond like 4 to 5 frames. And I started vomiting. It felt like my world had come crumbling down upon me. It felt like my world had ended. The thought that the country was watching a video that was everywhere. It was on my social media. It was on everybody's phone in India. It was on WhatsApp. It was on Instagram. It was on Facebook. And every 2 minutes, somebody would send me a message saying, hey, we saw a video of yours. And the fact that this video came from a member of the ruling party and it was circulating in their WhatsApp group, which means that they had the initial access to the video. Second, the number of people who were threatening me with rape on social media were followed by the prime minister, were followed by the home minister, were followed by the civil aviation minister on Twitter. So it wasn't direct, but it was done by people who owed allegiance to the BJP. A spokesperson for the party says, if you get out in the rain, you should be willing to get drenched. That was his reaction to the deep fake video that was created of me.
Well, let me ask you a question. And I hate to ask you this question. I really do. But you're out there, you know, you won't leave India. Do you fear for your life?
Actually, not as much my life, but the life of my family. You know, a couple of months ago, which I told you about, there was a dossier that an IB official gave me about each one of my family member and what they were doing and where were they working and what was their daily routine like. You know, when the book, my friend Gauri Lankesh, she was a journalist. You know, she was one of the most vocal journalists who was critical of the government. She was shot dead in 2017. One of the reasons being that, you know, she was fighting these Hindu nationalists. She was speaking about the right-wing groups operating in the South where she was working. What Gauri Lankesh also did was, 3 weeks before she was killed, she translated my book into a regional language. And when she was shot dead, we had spoken the night before and we were laughing at, you know, at the kind of harassment that came our way. And she said, Rana, stay strong. And the moment she was killed and the news trickled in, I felt a knot in my stomach that, okay, next could I could be next. Or anybody else for that matter. And it just sometimes feels that death is too close sometimes. Well, sometimes when I'm in a traffic jam and there are two cars next to me, one on the left and the right, and I'm cramped between them, I always keep looking around. What if somebody is trying to get into my car? What if somebody... I don't know, it's just, there is this fear. I mean, I won't deny it. Of course I do live in fear.
Rana Ayub writes from India for the Washington Post and other publications. Her book, Gujarat Files, Anatomy of a Cover-Up, came out in 2016. And you can find Dexter Filkins' article, Blood and Soil in Narendra Modi's India, at newyorker.com. We've got much more to come, so stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Jamie Lee Curtis descends from Hollywood royalty. She's the daughter of Janet Lee and Tony Curtis. But if that sort of Hollywood history isn't your thing exactly, you still know Jamie Lee Curtis, who shot to fame in the original Halloween.
Tommy, Halloween night, it's when people play tricks on each other. It's all make-believe. I think Richie was just trying to scare you.
I saw the boogeyman. I saw him outside.
The boogeyman can only come out on Halloween night, right?
Right.
Well, I'm here tonight. I'm not about to let anything happen to you.
Curtis eventually started playing in comedies like Trading Places with Eddie Murphy and the weirdly unforgettable A Fish Called Wanda.
I'm setting up a guy who's incredibly important to us who's going to tell me where the loot is and if they're going to come and arrest you, and you come loping in like Rambo without a jockstrap and you dangle him out a fifth floor window. Now, was that smart?
Okay.
Was it shrewd? Was it good tactics, or was it stupid?
Don't call me stupid.
Her new film is also in the oddly comedic vein. Curtis is one of the leads in Rian Johnson's Knives Out, which is a whodunit comedy filled with references to Agatha Christie and to the board game Clue. Curtis plays the daughter of the film's very, very rich and very, very dead mystery author.
Mr. Blanc, I know who you are. I read your profile in The New Yorker. I found it delightful. I just buried my 85-year-old father who committed suicide. Why are you here?
Jamie Lee Curtis sat down recently with The New Yorker's Rachel Syme.
Do you have a history with whodunit movies?
No. I am the anti-mystery girl. I'm the anti-mystery girl. I don't like horror films. I know.
How can that be?
It's just sort of cute. There's not a movie
that my friends haven't all said, oh, I'm going to go see this movie. And then they look at me and they say, but you can't go.
You know, there's this new thing that people do where they read. It's like a whole trend of people who read the Wikipedia for a scary movie before they see it. Like they
so
spoil
they know
it for
what
themselves.
Happened. Well, I'm going to tell you a secret.
Yeah.
I was making My Girl in Florida, and the makeup man had done Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
And he wrote me a sheet, which I took with me into the theater with a little flashlight, and I sat in the back row by myself. And it read, when Jody goes to the storage locker, close your eyes and ears, and wait for the second scream.
Oh, my God.
And so I would look at my little list, and I'd be like, oh, there she goes to the storage locker. And I would cover my ears, close my eyes, curl up in a little ball, and sing Au Clair de la Lune in my head. Au clair de la lune, mon ami Pierrot. Until I heard the first scream, and then I heard the second scream, and then I could open my eyes. Mm. The unexpected is terrifying for me.
Let's talk about your beginnings as an actor. Did you resist it at any point that you could have gotten into it? I mean, I know you went to a year of college, started acting, never went back. That's the story?
No.
Okay.
It was the last thing in the world. I went to college where my mother was the most famous person to have ever graduated. It was the only school that took me with my D plus 840 combined SAT average. I say that only because that was the reality of my life. A friend of mine from Beverly Hills had a tennis court behind her house, and a man who had been the tennis teacher who would teach people at her house. And he said, you know, they're looking for Nancy Drew. I'm managing actresses now. And they're looking for Nancy Drew at Universal. You should go up for it. And I said, oh, okay. I was home from college. And I went up and auditioned and didn't get the job. Mm. But somewhere somebody said, oh, she was whatever. I don't even know what they said. But they said something. Because all of a sudden he said, you know, you should stick around. You could get work. And all of a sudden I called my college. I said, can I do a drama class and get credit for drama if I go to acting class? Trying to be an actor. Can I break into show business in a paper for a month?
And get school credit for
it. And get school credit for it. And they said yes. And then I auditioned for a program which is no longer in existence, which was a contract system. They used to put people under contract,
well,
I'm sure.
I was going to say, when I read that, I thought, God, she must have been the last person under contract
virtually,
at Universal Studios.
I was virtually one of the last people. I actually told the woman who ran it, a woman named Monique James, after I finished my audition, I said, look, I know that you take some time to decide, but I'm going back to college in 2 days, so I need to know by Tuesday because I'm going back to college. And so they called and said yes. And so I quit college and became an actor, and I've been an actor since that day. Never in a million years thought I'd be an actor.
And I mean, in terms of, you say you never thought you'd be an actor.
Ever.
I mean, what I want to know is, how did you learn? Like, do you have a sense of what the craft is that goes all the way back to the beginning, or is it something that's kind of ad hoc that has developed over the years?
Totally, just sort of what I've picked up, what works, what doesn't work. I have learned that whatever it is, there is no formula for anyone. There is no one way to do it. There are a million ways to approach something, and every actor will come in with a different way. There have been times where I have felt less than because other people seemed more articulate. I will tell you, I remember I did a wonderful movie with John Borman called The Tailor of Panama, and it stars Jeffrey Rush. And Jeffrey and John are both intellectuals, and they're both deeply into character, and
they do method work.
Well, they just dig deep and excavate everything. And I put on the watch of the character and am ready because I cut my teeth in horror movies. So you don't have any time. You just show up as the person and you do the work and you get a take or two, and then they have to move on because there's no time. But the truth is, there is no depth. Mm. Actors listening to this, wherever you are.
Yes, she's about to drop some truth.
The truth is, there is no depth that you have to go to. It doesn't matter. It's about creating something real. And whatever it takes to do that, do it. But I don't. I have found that when I try to be a really good actor, I'm not a good actor because I'm all of a sudden very self-conscious. I'm thinking about things in a way that's just not the way I do it. And I have just found since I started that the best thing I can do is I read it once, I kind of know what it is, and I show up, I know what I'm supposed to say, and it has worked out that way in every area of my life.
Going back to starting out in horror, I mean, I know a little bit of the whole origin story of how Halloween came about, but again, as a person who doesn't like scary movies, it's funny that that should be...
It's the weird irony, I know.
Yeah.
I will tell you this. I had been on a TV series called Operation Petticoat, which...
So like an Old West thing?
Well, no, it was a remake of the Tony Curtis, Cary Grant comedy set on a pink submarine in World War II.
Not what I would have guessed.
That was a movie.
Yeah.
Where five army nurses get picked up on an island and are on this submarine and get trapped on it. They remade it at Universal when I was under contract as a TV movie. Mm-hmm. And I was cast in the part that was opposite the part that my father had played in the movie.
That's not twisted at all.
No, it's almost incest, but not. It's like it's generational incest. And while we were shooting the movie, it got picked up as a TV series. The show did not do well, and I was fired. I thought my life was over. I thought my career was over. I thought I would lose my contract. And 2 weeks later, the audition for Halloween came up. Had I not been fired from a show that only lasted two episodes before they canceled it, I would never have been in Halloween and my life would have never changed.
Do you know why you got the job? Did you ever ask
later on? I auditioned many, many, many times. I know you start whittling it down. You start going, oh, I like her. Bring her back. Bring her back. Bring her back. And then it was between me and one other woman whose name I know, but I will never say publicly. And I'm sure the fact that I was Janet Leigh and Tony Curtis's daughter, that my mother had been in Psycho, mm-hmm. that wasn't going to not help the promotion of the movie somehow. Like, if you're going to choose between this one and this one, choose the one whose mother was in Psycho, because it will get some press for you.
Sure.
And so I'm never going to pretend that I just got that all on my own. Like, I'm just a little girl from nowhere getting it.
Were you reticent to do the revisit?
This current revisit?
The current
Not
revisit.
At all.
No.
No, because I read it.
And that theme, the theme of trauma, speaking
trauma
to you.
Trauma was it. Yeah. I've always, even H2O, for those of you who've seen it and don't hate me for it, you know, the goal of H2O was both time, that 20 years had gone by and we were still all in show-off business. Here we all still were working. And trauma, because in that movie, she is an alcoholic and a drug addict trying to hide who she is by changing her name and running.
Was it important to you that they also explore addiction?
Well, it is a byproduct of trauma, by the way. Mm. Painkillers, alcohol, it is the balm that heals people when they are so traumatized. It's a natural evolution of trauma is to end up with drugs and alcohol.
Has it been 20 years for you in recovery?
I am 21 coming up in February.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Has that been fairly unexpected for you, too, to be kind of like a public representative for treatment and recovery?
Public representative for a private issue.
Yeah, for a private issue. Yeah.
I was so terrified when I got sober from a 10-year run on Vicodin and alcohol. I was terrified about being outed. I was terrified of the tabloids. I would feel so embarrassed by that exposure of a secret, of a flaw, of a human frailty. And then I was actually doing an interview for Red Book magazine about a book that for children that I had written. My teenage daughter was sitting with me at that moment. We were at the table. I believe the author is Amy Wallace. And I remember we were sitting there and I was talking about how great my life was and how happy I was and how much better. I kept saying the word better. I kept saying, like, Annie and I are getting along better and Chris and I are getting along better. And my life is so much better. I kept saying the word better. And at one point she said, well, what do you attribute it to? And in that moment, I remember I looked out the window and I thought, do I, don't I? And then I thought, I do. And I turned back and said, I think because I've been sober for over 2 years.
And I think it's interesting how over the years, the stories you've been telling about your own past with opiates and addiction has dovetailed with your thoughts on maybe the exacting beauty standards in Hollywood and all, and how you sort of want to push back against them. I've read in several places you've talked about how you had a procedure done, and that was
yes, it was an eye job because I was on the movie Perfect and Gordon Willis, the great cameraman, in a courtroom scene, looked at me one day and said, "Yeah, I'm not shooting her today," like that. Every picture of me as a child, I have big bags under my eyes, dark circles. I have always had it. And I was puffy that day, for whatever reason. And I was mortified, just so embarrassed, so deeply embarrassed, that right after that movie, I went and had an eye job.
Wow.
And that's when I found Vicodin. And then, you know, the cycle of addiction began with that. But I have done enough plastic surgery attempts. I pulled some lipo on me at one point. None of it works. It just didn't work. It makes you feel worse. There's a phrase, it's in recovery, but I apply it to my life fully, which is when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror, I am looking at the problem. I'm also looking at the solution. Mm. Like, it's in me. And plastic surgery and all these external fixes are society. They're charlatans. It's all advertising and money-making. Not one of these people, not one doctor. Now, I'm not talking about plastic surgeons who fix wounded veterans.
Sure.
I am not talking about people who do altruistic help for...
Right.
I am talking about these charlatans that draw you in with promises of you remove this, you remove that, you can inject this, you can inject that, and that ultimately you're going to be beautiful and feel better. And I don't know anyone who's had procedures who feels better. They look in the mirror and they feel fraudulent because it's not real.
Hmm.
And I am one of those people. I let my hair go gray. I have tried it. It didn't work. It felt like it made things worse in a way. And that has just been something that I've kind of carried on for a long time.
Are there any roles that you've done that you think are kind of unsung? Like no one asks you about them?
Please. And... You know what? I get so much effing attention. It's just obscene. I mean, really. I just can't even for one second.
Pretend to think that there's some hidden gem one's asked you about
way,
ever.
Hidden gems, even if there is, it doesn't matter. I've been doing this for a long, long time, and I've been successful at it since I was 19. I have been told I'm fantastic every day. There's not a day I don't walk down the street and somebody goes, "Hey, love you, you're fantastic." And I appreciate it. I get it. It's sort of been my gig, so I don't need any more attention. I get plenty of people telling me that they appreciate what it is I've had. An extraordinary life.
Jamie Lee Curtis talking to The New Yorker's Rachel Syme. Curtis is one of the stars of Rian Johnson's Knives Out, and you can find even more from their conversation online at newyorker.com. Knives Out was one of the big movies of the Thanksgiving weekend, and looking ahead to Christmas, the most anticipated thing on the docket is probably Little Women, Greta Gerwig's new adaptation of the novel. Gerwig told me recently that she's got a lot of personal history with Little Women.
It was in a community theater production, a children's production, and I played Joe.
This is in Sacramento.
Yes. I remember I was wearing my hair. Joe had this line, Meg says, "You're almost a young lady now. You'll turn up your hair soon." And Joe says, "If turning up my hair makes me a woman, then I'm going to wear it in two tails until I'm 20. And I remember thinking, I'm sort of not saying this right, but this is all I have. I mean, I think in some ways, maybe you become a director because you're in some way know your own limited capacity as an actor. So you get to vicariously live through other people.
I'll talk with Greta Gerwig on the New Yorker Radio Hour next week. And there's more to come this hour, so stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Helen Rosner is a food correspondent for the New Yorker, and she interprets that beat pretty broadly. She's as likely to write about the ethics of reviewing or the Me Too issues plaguing restaurant kitchens as she is the perfect recipe for rhubarb. So she had a lot to talk about recently with the Los Angeles chef Nikki Nakayama, who's been featured on the Netflix show Chef's Table, and whose restaurant has been called one of the very best in America. Here's Helen.
Not long ago, I had one of the best meals that I've ever had. It was at a restaurant called Ennaka in Los Angeles, and the kind of food that they serve there is called kaiseki. Kaiseki is a type of Japanese cuisine that you might not be familiar with. It's not that common outside of Japan. It's an incredibly formal, ritualized, elaborate meal that unfolds over the course of hours. There are dozens of courses. The chef at Ennaka in Los Angeles is a woman named Nikki Nakayama. I visited her in the kitchen a few days after I'd had my meal at Ennaka, and when I showed up, she gave me a tour.
And then this is our dish pit area, but trust us, it's a lot more organized when we have service. There's just a lot going on because we have so many dishes. It's like incredible. We had to build a shed outside just to house those dishes. That's why we love our dishwasher. Clemente's been with us for 3 years. So I feel very fortunate that people want to like hang out with us and stay. And even though we want to kill each other sometimes, it's very normal.
Nakayama was born in LA and she grew up there. Her parents are Japanese immigrants who owned a seafood distribution company, so she spent her time as a kid working in the warehouse or hanging out in the office. She figured she was going to become a musician, maybe a pop star, but she ended up spending 3 years studying traditional Japanese cooking in Japan. And in 2011, the culmination of all of that training and running a couple of other restaurants in LA, she opened Ennaka.
And then this is my work area. I work here.
The kitchen at Ennaka is the first one that Nakayama has been able to build from the ground up. She designed it to suit herself. She's 5'1", and so everything is at counter height or lower. She has notes pasted up by her workstation and near the pass, reminding everyone how to feel, what the mood is, what Ennaka is all about.
But one of the most important notes that I had was actually stuck outside the door, because I felt that this is a very sacred space for me. And I mean, we've all been in kitchens where the environment hasn't always been a friendly one or hasn't been like very conducive to, you know, good things. So I had a note outside that said, good things start now. So basically when you walk in, it's like a reminder to tell yourself that leave all your shit outside. Don't bring it in. Don't bring it in. But that's since fallen off. But generally everybody gets the idea.
When Nakayama talks about these unfriendly environments, I think part of what she's referring to is high-end kitchens in general. Those spaces tend to be pretty bro-y. Almost all of the chefs that are running those kitchens are men. And within the already pretty sexist high-end restaurant world, high-end Japanese cuisine is an area that remains particularly closed to female chefs. Nakayama's response to this is to staff her kitchen almost entirely with women. And that includes her right hand in the kitchen and at everything else, her sous chef, Carol Ida.
I'm the sous chef here at Ennaka.
My partner and wife?
Yes.
Don't forget that part.
You're not just the sous chef. You're important in a lot of ways. Oh, and you have the most beautiful Romanesco.
We don't use a lot of Romanesco in Japanese food, but I'm sure we'll figure out a way.
Yeah.
Our first and, like, our go-to thing is, okay, let's just use the standard Japanese method to cook it and see what happens. And if all else fails, we just tempura everything.
Kaiseki is incredibly complex and very ritualized. Chefs train for years, sometimes decades, to become kaiseki masters. The difficulty for someone like Nakayama, who's trying to make kaiseki in California, is that the cuisine developed in Japan. It's a meal that reflects Japanese seasons, Japanese terrain. So to try to translate it to California can be complicated.
I think authentic kaiseki can only exist in Japan. Even for us, we've tried to plant certain plants that are native to Japan in this environment, and it doesn't work. Like, we've tried to put moss in that window behind you, and it doesn't survive because the environment doesn't allow for it to be. It's not humid enough. I don't like to call ourselves traditional kaiseki in any way, but I think our heart and our motive and our ideas about it feel very genuine and authentic to us and who we are. Because I think we're combining a lot of our knowledge of what Japanese cuisine is and also our personal experience of Japanese food and the things we know about it, and combining that with our upbringing in America, it's hard to pretend that we don't have one or the other. So the most authentic representation of who we are is to sort of blend a little bit of both.
So when you say we, you're talking about yourself and Carol?
Yes. Yes.
So when you opened Ennaka, Carol wasn't in the picture. Did you guys know each other then?
No.
But then you met and started dating, and then you decided to work together?
Yes. And it all happened sort of by chance, and it was a little bit crazy because I'd lost my sous chef that I'd been working with for 9 years. And then she's like, well, I know dashi and I know Japanese cuisine. Maybe I can come and help you just, you know, do some of the basic things that are really important. And my initial reaction was like, no, you're going to see what a mess I am and how crazy it can be behind there.
So everything is all together.
Yes.
You and Carol have, you were on the Out 100. You've sort of appeared together as a couple, and you're often described in the media as, you know, like a lesbian chef couple, Carol Ida and Nikki Nakayama. Do you think that that's an important part of your identity as chefs, or Ennaka's identity as a restaurant?
I didn't want that to be out there because I felt that it's already hard enough to be a female chef, to be judged for so many things, and another level of judgment is not what I want people to focus on when they're coming to eat. I want them just to think about the food and what we're creating. But as time has gone by, I realize and recognize that it's important to sort of put a voice out there to sort of encourage more support and more acceptance. I don't necessarily think that it's very important to tie us to that identity, but I understand how if we are positive about it, it's a good thing.
How has it been difficult to be a female chef?
Sometimes one can't help but wonder how serious people are taking you. There are times in the kitchen where I was like, if I was a man, they would never question me about this. But I don't know if that's true or not. I really, really don't. I don't know because I've never been a man. And I don't know what the opposite reaction would be. But sometimes it's easy to sort of fall back on that just to make yourself feel better. But overall, I feel that I've been very fortunate with Ennaka and that it's not an issue anymore. It used to be an issue with the other restaurants that I have, but for here, no.
You've told the story a couple of times of being at your sushi restaurant, was it? And what was it that a man came in and realized that he was going to be served by a woman and got up and left?
Basically, when he walked in, there was a couple of them, and then they walked in and they saw us and then just turned around and left. And I understood that, oh, he probably thought we weren't a serious restaurant, or, oh, this is not a good restaurant. So they just sort of didn't even try.
Sushi seems to be a uniquely sexist culture, even within the already difficult universe of
fine dining, sushi is really still the realm of men.
That is very true. I think for men in Japan, to have a woman in the kitchen is a distraction for them. And there's this constant belief that women have certain roles that we need to play, and when we're not doing that, we're being rebellious to structure. And rebellion to structure is like a number one no-no in Japan.
So all of your diners here at Annaka know who you are, right? You're pretty well known now. You've been on TV, you've been on a lot of magazine stories. Why do you still cook with the screen closed in front of the kitchen?
I cook with the screen closed because, well, overall, I do enjoy to be the ability to completely focus on the work. And I feel that it's a lot better for the environment to not have it be open kitchen. It's very intimate, and the industrial feeling of the kitchen is very overwhelming and not conducive to a nice, relaxing feeling. But most of all, I want people to come here and think about the food and not think about who's cooking.
So how has Annaka changed since you were on Chef's Table? So what happened?
So the first day Chef's Table came out, we were still taking reservations that were like where the phone was being forwarded to my cell phone. And I remember that it got really hot and we had to turn it off. And then Carol and I just sat there and stared at it for a bit. And we're like, what are we going to do? She's like, this cannot happen. We've got to figure out a plan. And I was like, who's going to take all those messages? I'm not going to take it anymore. I mean, we were booking up maybe like a week ahead, or at least every day we had customers in a good stable amount. But after Chef's Table came out, we became like a restaurant that was booking out 3 months in advance. But seriously, when that happened, Kara and I were like, we need to have a meeting with our staff because expectation levels are going to be really, really high, and we need to make sure that people come in, don't get disappointed. So that was the first thing on our mind. It's like, let's not piss anybody off.
Nikki Nakayama, the chef at Annaka, speaking with Helen Rosner of The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us. And next time, I'll be talking with Greta Gerwig, the director of Lady Bird, about her new adaptation of Little Women. I had a terrific time talking with her, and I hope you'll join us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frillman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Isaac Jones, Adam Teicholz, Allison McAdam, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow, to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at Deloitte.com/US/engineering advantage.